Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Coming up on today's program, Thailand says Burmese refugees shunned by other nations, Cambodian residents worse off after railway relocation, and every year hundreds of North Koreans make a dangerous journey but sometimes get caught. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Three Muslim Rohingya women have been reportedly shot dead in a confrontation with security forces at the makeshift camp in Burma's Rakhine State. The sectarian violence appears to have spilled across Burma, where there have been four killings of Burmese Buddhists, believed to have been carried out by Burmese Muslims in recent days. Up to 140,000 people, mainly Rohingya Muslims, have been displaced in two waves of sectarian unrest between Buddhists and Muslims in that part of the country this year, that have left 200 people dead. They are one of the world's most persecuted people, but it seems few countries are willing to provide refuge to them. Thailand says it is unable to find any other nation willing to accept about 2,000 Rohingyas from neighboring Burma. Johanna McCarthy speaks to Vivian Tan from the UNHCR.
We've actually been working with the Thai government trying to find that some people among this group who have family links in the region to explore what's possible if we could reunify some families. This has not happened for the moment, but we keep trying. In the meantime, Thailand has said that this particular group can stay for an initial 6 months in Thailand, and we hope that they will extend this temporary protection for a longer time.
We know that Australia has accepted a number of refugees from Myanmar in recent years. Are you hopeful that Australia will open its doors to this particular group?
I think that's really more for the Australian government to say, because resettlement is really based on each country's criteria and policies. So UNHCR submits resettlement cases for consideration by countries like Australia, the U.S., etc. And ultimately, it's up to each country to decide whether or not to accept these cases.
Tell us about some of the conditions in these Thai refugee camps, or refugee detention centres, rather. We do hear from human rights groups that they're overcrowded, that men are being separated from their families, that no one's allowed outside without special cause. It sounds pretty bleak.
Yes, overcrowding is a definite problem. I think these detention centres are not designed to accommodate such large numbers of people for such a long time. So UNHCR and several other agencies have been advocating with the Thai authorities for some time now to to first of all improve conditions where they are, to try to provide more room so people can move around a bit more so that they can exercise. And just in the medium term, we've asked that these people be relocated to a different location so that families will not be separated. And again, so that there will be more space for people to move around.
The UN, of course, recognises the Rohingya as one of the world's most persecuted people. What can you tell us about the conditions that Rohingya have been fleeing in recent years?
Well, generally, the Rohingya are not recognised as a citizens in Myanmar under the current citizenship law. So they face restrictions in their daily lives. There's limited freedom to move. This affects their livelihoods, their access to basic services and education. And this, I think, has been exacerbated by the intercommunal violence last year, which affected not just the Rohingya, but also other ethnic groups like the Rakhine and the Kaman. So there's actually up to 140,000 people who are internally displaced in Rakhine State at the moment. This last year's outbreak of violence, in addition to the daily restrictions that the Rohingya face, has driven many to contemplate, the safety, has driven many to try to seek safety and stability elsewhere. And it's driven some people to embark on dangerous boat journeys to try to get to other countries in the region.
Indeed, we heard this week that Thai authorities found the dead bodies of 9 people believed to be from Myanmar whose boat had sunk. And we know that there are an unknown number of people who have died in that way in the past few years. Is it really a sign of the deep risks that people are prepared to take to escape these conditions?
I don't know about this particular case. I had seen it in the papers, but I don't know if these are people who are fleeing persecution or if they are migrants. So that remains to be seen. In general, though, we are aware that thousands of people have left from the Bay of Bengal. The majority are believed to be Rohingya, with some Bangladeshi nationals among them. They've left on dangerous boats that often sink or capsize. Those who do survive are often detained upon arrival in Southeast Asian countries. So the conditions are really quite dire, and it really shows how desperate they are for them to take these risks. So UNHCR has been advocating with the Myanmar government to do something urgently to improve living conditions in Rakhine State so that people don't feel compelled to leave.
A new report in Cambodia has found that a railway project partially funded by Australia has significantly impoverished hundreds of people who were forced to relocate in late 2011. In response to local NGOs' research, Australia's aid agency, AusAid, and others say that steps taken since then have improved conditions and those families affected. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
The ongoing rehabilitation of hundreds of kilometres of Cambodia's decrepit railway has a checkered reputation. Proponents point out that taking goods off the overcrowded roads and putting them on trains will prevent accidents, create jobs, and boost the economy. Critics say that is all very well, but complain that the way the authorities and the government's development partners have gone about upgrading the rail network has damaged the lives and livelihoods of those forced to relocate. Around 1,000 households, that's about 5,000 people, either have been or will be relocated nationwide by the $142 million project, which is funded by the Asian Development Bank, the Australian development arm AusAid, and the Cambodian government. STT, a local NGO, has been documenting this relocation process, and in a report released Tuesday, says dozens of households relocated from Phnom Penh since 2011 had been made much worse off as a result of a badly designed resettlement process. Nora Lindstrom is STT's program development manager.
What we've looked at is the relocation of households from the railway tracks in Phnom Penh to the relocation site, which is about 20 kilometres away. You have 143 households that have been relocated to this place called Trapeang Anchang.
The 143 households that were moved to Trapeang Anchang did get some assistance. A small plot of land, some cash to compensate for the replacement cost of their former homes, and a few other items. But the relocation site is a long way from where residents used to work, and it seems many could not earn enough there. STT says that in less than a year, around half of the families left the site. When STT carried out its survey last July, it found that the 68 families that remained, mostly women and children, who are the most vulnerable and therefore the least able to move back to the city, were far worse off than those who had left. They were also much worse off than the 105 households who have not yet been moved from the railway tracks, but who will, at some future point, be relocated. Lindstrom says the key issue was household debt.
They've taken on that debt because they didn't get enough compensation to rebuild their homes and their lives at the site. It's often something like 7% interest rates per month, which is absolutely massive, and they can't afford it. So even if they had a job, all that money would simply go into repaying the debts. Now, the other problem is there aren't any jobs. 20 kilometres away from the city centre from their previous livelihoods is very far for poor households, and so they simply can't afford to travel back to their previous jobs. So people have lost jobs, incomes have gone down for households, and those who've been able to maintain their jobs, the net income, obviously is a lot lower.
Lindstrom says the relocation process does have some positive elements. A plan to restore incomes, though delayed, now looks to be working. And the families that once lived illegally along the railway will eventually own their plot at the relocation site, provided they stay there for 5 years. Radio Australia was unable to reach the point man for railway relocation in the Cambodian government, which has overall responsibility for resettlement. AusAid and the ADB declined to be interviewed directly. Each replied to a list of written questions with a broadly similar statement. In his response, ADB Country Director Eric Sidgwick said significant strides had been made for the affected families since STT had collected its data. By March, the average debt of most of the relocated families had dropped to $875, he said, and average monthly incomes were at nearly $375. Both AusAid and the ADB said the income restoration program had helped more than 60 families to set up small businesses, and said a social fund had allowed some to access cash loans to address food and health emergencies. Families at the site will be taught financial literacy classes to help them manage their money better. The ADB said these steps had helped address issues within STT's report. Both the ADB and AusAid said they would work with the government to ensure that lessons would be learned for future relocations.
Every year, hundreds of North Koreans make a dangerous journey, traveling thousands of kilometers. But their epic trips made by refugees don't always end well. 9 North Koreans, some as young as 15, have just been returned to Pyongyang after being arrested in Laos. After escape, arrests, and repatriation, the group now faces a dark future. Timothy Pope has more.
The group of young refugees probably thought they'd made it to safety. But after escaping North Korea and travelling through China, they were arrested in Laos. It's a popular transit point for those fleeing Pyongyang. From there, they can hop to Thailand and seek refugee status in South Korea. But for this group, it all went wrong. Laos authorities decided to deport them. Human Rights Watch Asia Deputy Director Phil Robertson.
We don't know why this case was different. We don't know why this group was apprehended when other groups have been allowed through. It may be that the right people were not paid off. It may be that there was a different group leading these people. It's really quite unclear. The only people that really know this would be the Laos authorities.
He says refugees from North Korea don't have a realistic alternative to Laos if they want to get away.
Now that Laos has proven that it will cooperate with North Korea to violate the rights of people that should be receiving asylum rather than being sent back, I think that the people who are assisting these North Koreans flee their country are going to have to be more careful when it comes to Laos.
The harrowing journey for these refugees starts long before the North Korean border. Since coming to power, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has bolstered border patrols to keep the population inside. North Korea's border with its southern neighbour is heavily militarised, so anyone wanting out is forced to cross north into China. Would-be refugees are forced to bribe soldiers and officials to look the other way while they make their escape. But South Korean activists say that's getting more difficult under the new regime. Kim Un-young from the Seoul-based Citizens Alliance for North Korean Human Rights says escaping is getting more and more risky.
The whole process is very dangerous, and plus, people cannot really tell anybody about their plan to escape, of course, and they secretly need to find out who can really help them. So the whole process is very dangerous because once they cut or once they deport from some third countries, they'll be severely punished.
But Ms. Kim says when they get to China, they face a journey of thousands of kilometres through a country where authorities regard them as illegal immigrants and would send them back to Pyongyang if they're caught. She says if they can't find help, usually from missionary groups or people smugglers, they don't have much hope.
If they find somebody could help them with money and directions, who know the directions all the way to the South Korea, only those people can actually try to escape from China.
So after braving all that, it would come as an especially big blow for 7 young men and 2 women to be arrested in a country that has historically helped them on their way. Ms. Kim said the South Korean Foreign Ministry didn't do enough during their 3 weeks under arrest in Laos to try and stop their deportation to China from where they were sent back to Pyongyang. But Phil Robertson disagrees.
The criticism of the South Korean government, in my view, is misplaced. Really, the villains here are the Laos government, the China government, and the North Korean government.
He says now the group is back in Pyongyang, they'll face interrogation, torture, and a long sentence in forced labour camps where inmates are starved.
The 9 that have been sent back, I expect, will be sent to such a camp. The fact that they were going through Laos leaves very little doubt in anyone's mind that they were trying to make their way to South Korea. So the North Korean authorities will probably treat them extremely badly.
The number of North Korean defectors has plummeted in recent years. In 2011, more than 2,500 made it all the way to Seoul. Last year, that dropped to only 1,500. As of March this year, only 300 people had arrived. Now, with a shadow cast over one of the major stops along the way, the road to South Korea has just become a lot more rocky.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Authorities in Vietnam last week wasted no time in breaking up an anti-China gathering, arresting at least 20 demonstrators. The protest was in response to the recent ramming of a Vietnamese trawler by the Chinese Navy vessel in disputed waters. Vietnam's prime minister has also chilled China for its actions in the South China Sea at the annual Shangri-La Security Dialogue in Singapore. For all the rhetoric, though, Vietnam is still keen to maintain cordial relations with China. Kandahar Sapati has the story.
The anti-China protest on Sunday in Hanoi was not the first. In fact, since 2011, more than a dozen such demonstrations have been held, and the authorities have been quite tolerant of the protests. This time, though, the communist regime took a tough stance on dissent, quickly breaking up the gathering and arresting at least 20 demonstrators. Christian Lemire, senior fellow for naval and maritime security at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, says the reason for the response was twofold.
It's done to appease China, but it's also done to make sure that protests are not becoming the norm within Hanoi.
While Hanoi fears anti-China protests could mushroom into wider anti-government movements, Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung, speaking at the annual Shangri-La Security Dialogue in Singapore, did chide Beijing indirectly for its aggressive stance in the South China Sea.
Somewhere in the region, there have emerged preferences for unilateral might, groundless claims, and actions that run counter to international law and stem from imposition and power politics.
Territorial disputes in the South and East China Seas have been on the rise, with Beijing increasingly asserting its claims and expanding its naval activities in the waters. Speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogue, China's Deputy Chief of the People's Liberation Army, Lieutenant General Qi Jiangho, justified Beijing's position.
The Chinese government's stand has been very clear. Our attitude on the South China and East China Seas is our Chinese sovereignty, and we are very clear about that. So the Chinese warships and the patrolling activity are totally legitimate, and it's uncontroversial to patrol within our territory.
Vietnam and Philippines have been the two most vocal opponents to China's claims to disputed islands and reefs in the resource-rich waters, which are also busy sea lanes crucial to trade. The U.S., too, seeing the rise of China, is rebalancing its strategic interests with the intention to commit 60% of its naval forces to the Asia-Pacific by 2020. And in an attempt to balance and strengthen its bargaining position vis-à-vis China, Vietnam is building up its relations with other powers like Japan, India and the US. But with China as its ideological ally and its largest trading partner, Hanoi is also careful not to sideline Beijing, says Christian Lemire.
He was also keen to stress that Vietnam would not be the base of any foreign military bases, and nor would it be aligned with any country militarily against China. So really, he was criticising China and also offering olive branches to China to demonstrate that Vietnam is not necessarily an enemy.
In recent times, there have been media talks about a possible reopening of Vietnam's former Soviet and US naval base at Cam Ranh Bay to foreigners. The base is currently home to a Russian defence industry and is the site of a maintenance and repair facility where foreign warships, including those from the US, pass through regularly for service. China does fear that this could well be a move to contain it. But Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung, keen to promote strategic trust with China, has called on both Beijing and Washington to promote peace in the region.
We attach special importance to the roles played by a vigorously rising China and by the United States, a Pacific power. We would expect and support the roles of the United States and China once their strategies and actions conform to international law and respect the independence and sovereignty of nations, to not only bring about benefits to them, but also to contribute genuinely to our common peace, cooperation and prosperity.
Meanwhile, Christian Lemire says while the situation remains tense, the chances of any outright conflict over disputed territorial claims in the South China Sea will remain limited.
There's always a possibility of some form of limited conflict by accident, But conflict by design is currently improbable, and the fact that it's law enforcement vessels that are often at the forefront of these disputes is a signal that these countries are looking to contain the possibility of conflict rather than lead towards it.
And finally on the program, websites in Singapore now have to apply for a license if they want to keep operating. Singapore's blogging community is furious, saying the new regulations amount to nothing more than political censorship. Under the new rules, websites that post political content and have more than 50,000 unique visitors a month must apply for a license at a cost of $50,000. In the past, all websites were automatically licensed. Anna Hipsley speaks to Sinapan Samadoraya. He is the president of an NGO and research body called the Think Center.
So is there a real fear that if the government or the people who end up deciding if these websites and blogs can have a license, is the fear that if they don't like the content on the website or on the blog, they'll shut them down by refusing to grant them a license?
This is not about a license. No, I mean, earlier we already have a class licensing. That means any website or blog have to be registered in a sense. What they are talking about is paying a 50,000 fee on top of that. Now, this registration as those who have been the heavier hit with political content means there is a restriction. There's a fear. You have $50,000 and it's easy to make any mistake and they can deprive you of the $50,000. And not everyone can afford that $50,000. Earlier, I think foreign press and foreign magazines were given more than $100,000 deposits, no? $500,000 if I'm right, to operate in Singapore. So similarly, with such heavy financial burden on their head, anything can go wrong. Anytime they find it wrong, they will take the $50,000 away. So it hurts the individual who's going to run the block. You know, it's normally run by individuals.
So it's a way around them effectively banning a website by making it so expensive to apply for a license.
It is really that. I mean, it's not. They don't use the word ban. Neither is it a law. It's a policy. So as such, it is a compounded fine. No, I mean, if you do a mistake, we will just take away the money that you have deposited. So, of course, it's going to create fear. No, I mean, it deprives the space. You worry what you're going to write. You have self-censorship coming in. Already, self-censorship is common in Singapore. The blogs are the only one that has more voice. And now, with this type of thing, I think less voices of different opinions will be expressed. That's what they think, you know. Yeah.
There have been calls for some protests over this move, over these new regulations. But given that the government has pretty much all of the seats in Singapore's parliament, is there any likelihood that this new regulation will be changed or overturned?
I mean, Singapore's government is run by one party for more than 50 years. And they, in any three sittings, they can change the policies and rules. So it's up to the ruling party and its parliament whether they feel this is it did not go through parliament as a policy. It went through the ministry. So if the ministers and others feel wrong, they should instruct their civil institutions or their civil service not to do this. No? So basically, I think it is up to the ruling party to think carefully, you know, whether the how the opinion poll has come out and people are even willing to protest.
What exactly are they so worried about, given that they do have that absolute majority?
I mean, it's true, they have quite a two-third majority in parliament. But the number of votes have gone down. And in the past, there were only two or three parliamentarians directly elected into parliament. Now we have about seven parliamentarians from the opposition party, mainly the Workers' Party, directly elected. And one was a group constituency. So I think being a monolith with only one or two opposition seats for symbolic reason, or somehow they got elected, right now we have seven seats and more votes, actually. They got less than 70% of the popular vote. I think that is the mindset we have. They wanted to have everything for themselves in full control. Yeah.
Do you think they'll take any notice of the public backlash against these regulations put in by the ministry?
Well, the Prime Minister, in the last few months after the last election also, he said, we will listen to the people, we will talk to the people, we even have a conversation, national conversation. All that will be... I mean, they are already critics saying all these are just a showpiece, not just a show to us. But now the criticism will get louder. So what it means is they have to really touch ground and really understand the people. And I think there's a big gap in the perception of the young people and the government, or the ruling party, rather. So I think they may have to take note of it. I mean, fundamentally, they want to win bigger in the next election. That's what they think, that by controlling such a way, in this way, they may get more votes, but actually it may be the opposite.
Before we end off on today's program, I just want to tell you about the other edition of Focus Asia Pacific that you can catch from PCJ Radio International, which is a 15-minute edition presented by Andy Sennett. The transmission times are Sunday, 13 to 14 hours UTC, targeting Southeast and East Asia on 11835 kHz. To Europe on Sunday from 13 to 14 hours UTC on 5955 kHz, and that's on June 9th. Listeners in North America can also catch this from midnight to 1 hour UTC on 9925 kHz, June 10th. All the times that I mentioned are in UTC. For more information on our broadcast and transmissions, you can check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com. If you want more information about these or other stories reported on in Focus Asia Pacific, check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com, Focus Asia Pacific, and then FAP. I'll say that again because I totally made a mistake of that. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Yes, it's been a long week. It's been a very long week. If you wish to contact us here on the program to let us know what you think, and if you have any comments or story ideas that you'd like to hear, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team that put the program together, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well, hoping that you can join us again very soon for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Until next time, so long and bye-bye.